Welcome to the No Film School podcast. This is Gigi Hawkins, and this week I speak with Emmy-winning editor Lucas Harger, whose work on the new documentary, The Lions of Mesopotamia, captures not only a powerful story, but a powerful workflow when it comes to crafting this story. The film follows the Iraqi national soccer team's journey to become Asian Cup champions in 2007 during the bloodiest days of the country's civil war. In victory, the national team made up of Sunni, Shia, and Kurdish players, the sons of sworn enemies battling in a bloody war, united the country in its darkest hour. And over a decade later, the players sit down to tell their story. In my conversation with Lucas, we talk about premiering at South By in 2024 and the unexpected through line of football as a cultural and identity unifier, despite the atrocities going on at the time the documentary is revisiting. Lucas also talks us through gathering footage, organizing it, and using that to craft a deeply personal journey of these players, as well as the tools he used to create seamless collaboration along the way with people across the filmmaking team. Lucas also speaks to his work as a commercial editor and how he works across feature length and short form to craft these stories. And now, my interview with Lucas Harger. Welcome, Lucas, to the No Film School podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is great.
Where are you tuning in from?
I am in St. Louis, Missouri, center of the country.
Yeah. Amazing, amazing. I always love meeting filmmakers outside of New York and LA and learning about the vibrant industries that are outside of these bubbles that we live in. How did you end up there?
It was a little bit happenstance. I grew up in Michigan and kind of in the sticks of Michigan.
I went to Michigan.
Oh, Grand Rapids. I was like 45 minutes outside Grand Rapids.
Spent many a Thanksgiving in Grand Rapids.
Oh,
it's,
really?
It's like a wonderful place.
Yeah. That is like, I know. I miss it. It's a great place. I grew up in Michigan and then kind of wandered around through a handful of different colleges and then ended up eventually graduating from one just outside of town here in St. Louis. And then I moved into St. Louis because my family had then moved to Wisconsin and I wasn't going to go home or anything like that. So I moved into town with some friends and then just started freelancing. And so that's kind of how I wound up in St. Louis. And my wife, then girlfriend, had 2 years left at the college. And so, and she graduated, moved into town. And then we just kind of fell in love with the city and stayed.
Amazing. I love this Midwest love happening here. It's amazing. Now, did you study anything related to film when you were in undergrad?
Nope. I ended up graduating with a music business degree, which was essentially like pre-law and creative contracts, which is kind of helpful, but nothing to do with film specifically at all, craft or law. So no.
What led you to this position of being now editor of a feature documentary? What was that journey?
Growing up, it's kind of an adjacent skateboarding up and coming editor story. It was all about wakeboarding. And so I made a lot of wakeboarding videos. There was a vibrant wakeboarding community and a bunch of my friends went off to like ride in the X Games and like all this crazy stuff. And so they were always in need of like more videos and sponsor videos and pitching them to potential brands and sponsors. And so growing up, I just loved doing it. And it was a lot of, and in wakeboarding video and wakeboarding culture, there was like a little bit more of a narrative that would happen throughout, you know, a 3 or 4 minute segment. And so we would all kind of like try and figure out some kind of like story element to weave through. And like, I liked movies, like it was fun to watch them, but I wasn't like obsessed with movies but what I really fell in love with was like having an idea and then executing it. And then everybody sitting around the TV when it was done and like pressing play for the first time. That was what like really hooked me. So it was kind of the community of making a movie and the communal aspect of it that I fell in love with before I fell in love with like the craft.
It makes so much sense that you are the editor of Lions of Mesopotamia, because this is a story that stems from this through line of football. Soccer, but football to everywhere else in the world. Yep. But there is a story about culture and identity and sort of people coming together despite these atrocities, and specifically like finding the humanity through this game. So it totally makes, like, I love that there's this wakeboard origin story. And I actually didn't even know that there were wakeboard videos that had like more of a story focus. So that's such a cool discovery. Now, how did you come to this particular project?
So the long story, I suppose, quickly. So I moved into St. Louis and just started freelancing and wound up at this place here, Brut & Strobe, and as an internal editor servicing their production department, which was short form commercial work. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of other relationships from my past freelancing life. And so I started to bring in more work, we started to need to hire more people. And then I came on and as one of the partners and started the post facility here. And so as a part of that, the documentary has always been my heartbeat kind of throughout all of that, even when we were doing short form. Mm-hmm. And I believe documentary is really the editor's medium. That's like the editor's playground. And I love being lost in a sea of footage. And so I had been cutting docs, but I'd also been cutting a bunch of commercials and some scripted stuff for friends. And then this film came about. The production company, Lucian, the director, and the production companies attached found themselves in need of an editor. Mm-hmm. And so they just started to ask around. And one of the creative executives at one of the production companies heard my name through a directing duo, Aaron and Winston, that I had worked with. And then his assistant was also like an extra in a film. It was like very, like my name came at him from like two or three different ways. And was like, hey, I think we should probably talk to this editor. And so I chatted with him. He hooked me up with Lucian. Lucian and I hit it off. Mm-hmm. And then we just kind of dove in head first. I mean, production had already been going on. They were probably 75% of the way through production. And so we just kind of jumped into the process and just started piecing it together. So, yeah.
I want to drill into that moment that you and Lucian were meeting for the first time. You know, a lot of our listeners are folks who are entering this space looking to grow into roles like, you know, editing, being the lead editor on a project like this. Where did you guys meet in person? Was it a Zoom? What were the questions that you were asking each other? What context did you have for the project at that point?
Yeah, I had a deck and a sizzle. They sent that to me pretty early on. And our first call was just on the phone. Later we would Zoom, but we just started to chat on the phone. And with the materials in hand, it was really like a mutual, I guess you could say, interview process. Mm-hmm. But it was like, do I want to work on, you know, for a project like this, you're like, is this somebody and something I could work on for the next 2 years? Mm-hmm. And if the answer is no, then I wouldn't do it because you're setting yourself up for a pretty miserable 2 years if you don't like the content or you don't like the people that you're working with. And so it was kind of a mutual exploration of like, you know, what's your working style? What's your aesthetic? What's your vision? Where do you see this story going? So it was a lot of kind of poking and prodding the idea, the process, how he directs, how I edit, you know, because I like to take footage and then absorb it and then start to work with it and start putting scenes together without too much involvement from the director. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we've had several conversations and we're like very in lockstep, but I like to go away and have my own thought, time, I guess.
Yeah.
And start putting stuff together, and then we can start ping-ponging back and forth. And so some people don't like that. They're like, oh no, you can put your hands on the keyboard, I'll put my hand on the mouse. And it's just like, that's not how I work. Yeah. And so, you know, just kind of feeling out what the potential process could be. And so, but I think for feature work, for long form work, it's always about the collaboration and the topic. Mm-hmm. For me, those are the conversations that I focus in on, because you know, can't be too sweaty, too needy, too wanting, too excited, not questioning enough. You know, you have to yourself really interview the director and the collaborator that you're going to work with just as much as they're, you know, interviewing you.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that you pointed out green flags, which we've talked about on the past in the podcast, the green flag being like him agreeing that you guys could work together with the working style of you going off and trying to work through these scenes and have your own thought around it. Let's talk about this initial moment where you start to receive the footage as they're, you know, I think 70% through production. And specifically, I assume that is a moment where you are living in a sea of footage by yourself. Where do you start and what tools and organizing principles do you start to sort of build that initial foundation for the story?
Yeah, this one was a little different in that they had 75% of the footage shot, but 0% of it was translated and subtitled. And so first was just like getting this in English.
Yes.
Because it's all in Arabic and Kurdish, like different dialects. And so that took a very long time. And so for me, it got to the point where I was just like so insanely frustrated because I was like, I just want to go. Like, what are they saying? I just want to start cutting.
Yeah.
But there was that couple few months of waiting for translations and then getting them cross-referenced and checked and making sure everything was okay. So once that was done, it was like, all right, we have all of the interviews and now I can just start watching them down. And, you know, there were some like six to 10 hour interviews per subject. And so it was like, you know, a 2 day stretch of interviews with each. And so it was like, it was a good chunk of footage that we had right out of the gate. And so for me, it's that first watch is like holy, you know, that's like mm-hmm. sacred ground.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you know, I view myself as the true first audience of the film and the most put together state that it will ever be, but I'm still the first audience of the film. And then it's my job to package it up and to deliver it to the second audience in the mm-hmm. most succinct and powerful way that I can. And so that first watch is super important to like take note of what's sticking out to me, whether it's in interviews, whether it's a facial expression or a delivery of a line or the repetition of a line or just something mm-hmm. that's like, oh, there's something powerful in that moment. I don't exactly know what it is, but it's powerful and kind of like setting that aside.
Are you dragging, are you taking the media and putting it into Premiere and tagging within the timeline?
Yeah. So I'm putting into Premiere and then I'll use like range markers to, you know, put different themes in what they were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And then within that, when I start to like have my selects or things that are sticking out to me, I'll elevate those on different video layers. I never throw anything away because once you delete something or you only have a selects reel, very rarely are you going to go back. Like once it's gone, it's gone. And for me, it's like, I don't even know what a select is, but you know, I don't know the film enough to say that this is important and this is not,
right.
You know? And so I keep everything there, but it's just elevated at the time that I thought it would be interesting or it will be interesting. I'll elevate it on the layer, but I don't throw anything away.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause especially in that early stage, I mean, it's like, you know, I don't believe in good shots or bad shots, just appropriate shots, you know, mm-hmm. not like you just pick the most appropriate thing for the moment.
Yeah.
How can you possibly say this is good or this is bad? You don't know enough right now. So
right.
It's like, keep it there. And so that's what I'm doing. I'm going through in Premiere, tagging with, you know, what they're saying, the gist of what they're saying, so I can fly through markers. This one, it's already translated to text, and so using the text window a lot in Premiere. And then just elevating things on different video layers to kind of give myself a cue of what I felt powerful at the moment. And then just taking a lot of like pen on paper notes as I'm going.
In this like sacred time of the first watch, which is such a... Weirdly, I've talked to so many editors, but I have yet to identify this moment. What else do you do to prepare for this? Are you like, is this a day, like these are days where you block your calendar off completely and turn your phone off and you drink your coffee? I hear you make the best coffee in the office. Like, do you have any like kind of rituals around that so you can get into this mindset of being the first audience?
I don't know about rituals. I mean, I guess the biggest ritual for me is my space. Like mm-hmm. we are up at a post house, you know, there's seven of us editors and color and sound design and mix, and we all have our own offices and space. We don't have a pit. We don't really have. So it's like, for me, it's like curating and customizing this space. The only thing that happens in here is editing. You know, it's not also my bedroom or also this. So it's like very intentional to like make this space so hyper-focused on this specific craft. And so once I get in here, I'm editing like that. And that's all that I'm doing. So I don't have to do anything necessarily to get myself in the mindset on the day. And it is just blocking out huge chunks of time to watch through footage with running the post house and doing, you know, sales and supervise editing, everything else that goes through, there's like things, other things that I have to do. And so I can like pivot away from that and take care of those other business needs. And then I come back to my space and can get back to the zone pretty quick. But that's also a practice. Like once I started to have more responsibilities and things outside of just editing, I was like, I think I really need to get over this notion that I have to wait for my genius to come around, or I have to wait to be inspired. It's like, there's no time to wait to be inspired. You just have to be inspired and go.
And create so, that space to figure it out.
Yeah, 100%. And so for me, it was like starting some mental exercises or just trying to figure out how I can turn on the creative switch and go as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. And having a space like this as part of that, having like consistent collaborators with the other editors, and Elise Andert was the story producer on this film. So her and I would have a lot of conversations back and forth. And so those things helped me get into the zone pretty quickly and just like churn through footage, churn through cutting minutes, and like get the film on the timeline.
For our listeners who can't see Lucas's space, it's beautiful and feels like a very like, it does feel like a sacred space. I like it. The first thing I said was like, look at this amazing working space. And I think that's an important thing to protect, even if it is in your bedroom, but having a little area dedicated to your creative work. I think that's really important. For sure.
Yeah. And lighting is a huge deal. Mm-hmm. And like, I mean, just like there's these little things that are science, very well known, you know, color, temperature, lighting, turning off distress. Like there's all these like little things that you can customize any space to allow yourself to get in the zone. And I think it's just, you know, it's just paying attention to the things and paying attention to what works, and then paying attention more importantly to what doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah. And cut it out when in doubt. Yeah. Now let's talk about shaping the story of this film. You introduce us to a ton of people. I have this inclination like to say characters, because they, you know, here we are creating a documentary that is a, but it is a story that needs to be shaped so the audience can understand and have context. So I'd love to hear about how it came together from an editorial perspective. And I'd specifically love to hear about the decision to include this moment that I thought was so haunting and specific and provided me such context as somebody newer to this story. And that was about one of the players who came up, and in his family, they only had one shirt that they shared with everyone. So that stuck with me so much that I told my partner about it. And he said, "What? No, that can't be true." And I was like, "No, it's true. It's in the documentary. Like, look at this, look at this, look at this." And so when you're shaping the story and coming up with this big macro story, how do you find the balance of having these like very specific human moments that sort of like ground the story, especially when, you know, we're talking about a story that has such a global scale to it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it is finding those, it's finding the human elements. So because these interviews were long and they talked about their upbringing for a very long time, and there are tons of little different stories in there. One of the other ones that he actually talked about was in his early days of being a professional footballer, they paid the players with chickens.
Oh my gosh.
But it's identifying for us, we don't have a ton of time to set it up. We need to get to the first tournament within the first, you know, X amount of minutes, but we have so much to set up. And so for us, it was identifying the seed, the most specific seed that is like core to their mode of operation. And so for Nishat, who his whole family shared the single shirt, it was like very, and that was a result, you know, his dad was a taxi driver who ended up having a heart attack because of the sanctions, the U.S., you know, so there was all of these things kind of correlating around with it. And it was made the most poignant and manifest by the fact that they had to share a single shirt. This was afflicting the entire community, mm-hmm. you know, so it was a story about not just about how he got paid from being soccer, from being a professional, which was more isolated to him, but it was him in his, so it was emblematic of his family's suffering, but also the greater suffering of this time period of Iraqi living through the sanctions, the first mm-hmm. sanctions. And so that's what we did with all of the different characters. Is, and then right on the heels of him, you have Ahmed, who comes in and was like, my dad was one of the heads of the clan, of the richest clans in Iraq. Like, yeah. We were super loaded. And so it's like finding those things, but those things motivate them in different ways. And so when we were looking for those human moments and those human stories, it was like, what's the most powerful story that encapsulates this time period that we're talking about, as well as the character that we're trying to build, mm-hmm. that will then roll into the next tournament and the next tournament and the next tournament. And mm-hmm. so that was always what that we always held that front and center, is like, what are the stories that bring to light the most about the time period, the culture, and this person?
Yeah. Now, part you brought up the tournament, the first tournament, but part of the DNA of film about football and / soccer is gameplay. And we have these sort of tentpole moments throughout the film, these game set pieces, if you will. And of course, there's an entire industry, thriving industry around watching entire games. And my stepdad is British and actually records the games, yeah. which he sleeps through because he lives in California now, and goes off the grid and then watches it as if it were in real time.
Yeah.
You had the job of like cutting down these like iconic moments in sports history into just a few moments. Again and again and again. So what was the approach to that? And how did you distill it down?
Yeah, I mean, the distillation and the focus was predicated on what we had done to build up to this moment. One of the things that I find the most, you know, frustrating, is when people are constantly interrupting the thing that they've built up to with more mm-hmm. context. And so for us, it was like, let's establish and identify all of the context, all of the character context, all of the political context. We'll establish all of that. And then the gameplay is the payoff. Mm-hmm. The tournaments are the payoff. So the 2000 Asian Cup, the 2004 Olympics, and then the 2007 Asian Cup. It's like, those are the payoffs to what we've done. We've done our job.
Yeah.
Right. We've built it up. And so now we can just cut. We can have really punchy and succinct, but it's succinct to a point because we're paying off something. It's not just arbitrary, random gameplay. That was the first joy the people had since the sanctions. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, that's what that tournament meant. The first match of the tournament was overcoming the fear of being tortured. The second. So it was these things, we built up the context, and now we can drive specifically to this point. And so there's always an end goal to the game. It's not just recap the game and then who won, but it was recap the game, who were the key players in the game, for what purpose. You know, mm-hmm. we won that match and we couldn't talk to our fellow Iraqis because they opposed the regime. You know, mm-hmm. that was the whole point of the tournament. And so now we can cut with a very, very sharp scalpel, a gameplay that points to those more emotional character and geopolitical payoffs. And so mm-hmm. that was true in every match, and then broader in every tournament, was we always had an end in mind, a thematic and narrative end in mind to the match. So it wasn't just a match.
Yeah, that and that care, it like propels us into the next part of the story.
Right,
it's very effective. Now, what was the biggest challenge when it came to editing this film?
I mean, the technical challenge was, well, a couple of them. First, the language. And it was more so the challenge of getting it translated. Once we got it translated and it was solid, then it flowed. But it was really difficult to find people to translate it relatively quickly and well. So, that was kind of the challenge. There's a ton of archival. And so working with the archival team to constantly source media. Lucian and I were deep in Arabic YouTube looking for stuff that didn't exist in the English YouTube landscape. And so it was a lot of digging, a lot of finding footage and incorporating it. And you had these like great stories. So we had the 2000. It was like, it'd be great to recap the 2000 tournament. It's like, but this doesn't exist, right? And then it was like a couple weeks of searching. It was just like, we found it. There are all the games. Like, we can do it now.
Oh my gosh.
And so it was a lot, especially the early archival footage. And so, you know, that was a challenge. I think it was, there were some, I mean, there's some like pretty heavy emotional topics. There's a lot of footage to wade through, a lot of archival footage, a lot of dead bodies of all ages, a lot of torture footage, a lot of stuff like that, that, you know, we were very intentional and talked a lot about like making sure we didn't get into like, you know, for lack of, I mean, it's just like torture war porn or torture porn or like just bodies. You know, we can prove the point with stories. We can prove the point with the emotion. We can prove the point. We don't need the show.
Yes.
We don't need to go too far. And but there was all that footage in spades, obviously. And so there was a lot of that going through and having those conversations. And a lot of that footage wasn't the most fun to go through for weeks on end. And so those were probably like the most challenging parts. And then once we started, because my goal is to get the film on the timeline as quick as possible. Yeah. Just get it there so then we can actually start to edit. Mm-hmm. You can't edit something that there's not pre-existing media for. And so for me, it's just like, get this on the timeline and then we can start to shape and then we can start to, you know, give it its features and trim and cut and do all of that stuff, but just get it on the timeline. And so there's always that moment of like the really big first push to get the thing on the timeline. Mm-hmm. And so those are some pretty intense weeks and couple months just to get it on the timeline. And then it's just like a sigh of relief. It's like, we have a film now, let's like make it great.
Yeah.
And so, you know, those are probably some of the more specific challenges of it. And then, you know, there's always, I mean, this film was made by incredible people and it was really great to work with everybody. But once you are at a scale with a certain number of people and a certain type of people, just like maintaining and managing all of the politics and the feedback and making sure everybody's heard and incorporating, separating the wheat from the chaff and all that stuff.
When you were at the point where, you know, you and Lucian had taken it very far and you were gathering feedback, what was that incorporating feedback, revising process? Were you trying to take it as far as you can and then get fresh eyes and then incorporate that back in? And what were some like interesting findings from that part of the process?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of taking it as far as we could and then getting people to step into the process. The decision makers, if you will, it was a pretty small group of people, which was nice. We went further than that, but to have the people that were like wading through the feedback, and because you're kind of at a certain point, you're protecting the identity of the film and you're protecting the film from outside feedback. And a lot of times you have those decision makers at a certain handful of decision makers that have the film's best interest at heart. And then it's like, tell us everything you want to tell us about the film. And then we can distill what is best for this film and the one that we are making. And so that was always a good process. And it was like, we had some really great people and some really great thoughts. And so, but for Lucian and I, it was a process of forever whittling. Like, I think our first cut was like a couple hours, maybe 2 hours. I mean, it's just like, this could easily be a 3-part series. There's so many stories and so much there. And so, you know, I think we got it to like an hour and 50 minutes. It was like, there's no way this film can be any shorter. There's just no way. And it's like an hour and 27 now, you know? So it's like, but that was like, hey, this is a great story, but it's a little bit of a tangent. So that was a lot of the notes, is like, let's keep this thing like really dialed, really on straight line, and like tell the story front to back. And so that was a lot of it. There was a lot of conversation about the setup and how we got into the film. We wanted it with some sort of a cold open. And then we eventually landed on, we probably need to retell the last 40 years of Iraqi and U.S. relations in as quickly of a time as we possibly can. And so that turned into like, that turned into like the intro, if you will. And then it was also like, what else do people need to know? And it's like, oh, that Iraqis are absolutely mad about football, you know? And it's just, which I had never necessarily considered. I was like, Iraqis and football is just not anything. that I had seen or thought of up till that point. So it was like, yep, probably need to talk about that. And so it was a lot of that. Like, what are the must-haves to bring the audience along? And then how quickly can we say it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as this film is coming out into the world, I always feel like I get to be one of the first of the last audiences, or like the final audience. And I think that everything that you're saying, you've totally achieved. That's like in a way that I came out. When you come out of, and I'm not a sports person, I'll just caveat that, but I cared so much. And I think it's because of that work and that context that was provided and the work that you did to build out these characters. It's so powerful. Now, I'm curious, like in this phase that you're at where it's out, you premiered at South By, what was it like being in the room and watching people see it for the first time? What was that experience?
It was... The first one, I mean, I'm always like, did we miss something? We cut it, we did color, we did the online edit, and we did sound design and mix. So we kind of did the whole post thing here.
Yeah.
And I'm always just like, did we mess something up? Is it going to glitch? Is it going to freeze?
Oh,
so
stressful.
The first one is I'm just like white knuckling through the whole thing. And then I was like, oh, okay. Like nothing. We're fine. So then the second one was awesome.
Yeah.
And it was just, it's just great. So like, I mean, it's like this conversation, like, especially at South By, everyone's so kind and prone to like want to discuss in the Q&As. And then like hours after, you're just like talking about, I mean, just like this, the process, what stuck with you and why, and all of the other little stories kind of woven throughout. And so that's the best part, is like hearing people's reaction to it and being like, because you work for so long to achieve what you hope is the outcome, and what you hope is powerful and impactful. And then you kind of know, you kind of have a good idea, but it still is like two kind of people. Like, it's like my wife, and it's just, and it's, you know what I mean? It's like, I want it more general. And that's what I'm excited for the next one, because I still feel like South By is a little bit, a little bit siloed, just by the people. So now it's like, now I'm ready to go even wider and try and, get it on platform once we get through the sales process and it goes wider. It'll be awesome. And then beyond that, it's also like getting it to Iraq and getting it back to the Iraqis. And like, I mean, this is everything.
Their story.
Everybody knows where they were in 2007 when the Lions of Mesopotamia won the, everybody knows. And so this is such a powerful story for that country and all of these different cultures that are in this country. It's so powerful for them. And so that's what I'm excited for. That's what was awesome about South By. And that's what I'm excited for on an even bigger stage in the next phase of the process.
Cool. Now, as we wrap up here, what advice do you have for emerging editors or somebody who's just getting their start looking to do this work?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be to consume as much stuff as you can, poetry, novels, films, but I would say more than just like watching a ton of films is just consuming a bunch of other things, because it all rolls into, especially a doc editor, but I mean, editor is like a lifestyle. It's you only output as good as your inputs.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to be savvy with music, with sound design, with all of the things within the film, under the film's purview. Those things end up going at some point to specialists to do the sound design, the mix, the color, the treatments, all of that stuff. But you got to have a good design eye. You have to have a good project managerial process. I mean, there's just so much that goes into it. And so it'd be consume as much as you can, even if it's not directly related, even if you don't think it's directly related to the craft or to the industry, like consume it. And then it's just get your hands on as much footage as you can and just cut. Like, you got to cut as much as you can. Like,
yeah.
And you're going to cut a lot for free. I still cut a lot for free. And it's, you have those times where the paying gigs come in, you can have your commercial endeavor, you can have all of these other things where you know that stuff is solid, but you still do it for the passion. You still do it to make films, to make things that people want to see. And so, for me, It's cutting as much as you possibly can, getting your hands on as much footage as you can, and the way that you a lot of times level up to better and better projects is by entering through a couple free projects. Even if those ones don't, even if those collaborators don't turn out to necessarily be paying collaborators, you know this project was worth it. It goes in your reel, it goes on your book of work, and now you can use that and leverage that to the next one. And that's, you know, that's just about being intentional.
Yeah.
About your career and about your trajectory. And, you know, in St. Louis, maybe I have to be a little more intentional because I am not in a hub. But it is about being intentional with every step, with every project, with everything that you take. And so that's probably what I would say is be intentional and consume stuff as much as you can.
Nice. That's great advice. That's great advice. Especially the idea of meals and reels. Like you have your projects that are going to be for that get your heart beating and you put them in the reel and you figure out a way to make it work and you get a rep in, you know, that is valuable. Totally. And then you have the ones that feed you, which is great too. We love them.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, for sure.
Also
for
me, I'm always
Yeah, absolutely. For me, I'm always looking at three different categories. Mm-hmm. Like the creative has to be great, the money has to be great, or the collaboration and the potential future for collaboration has to be great. Those are the three things that I like kind of take in. Ideally, two of those are true, sometimes just one. But if none of them are true, like if they're jerks to work with, they have no money, and it's like subpar creative, like why are you even doing it? You know?
Yeah.
And so sometimes you take free work that's really creatively awful, but you have faith in this director, this executive producer, like you just feel like something could come of it down the road from the relationship. And so I'll jump at that before anything else. Like, you know, I'm always looking for people to invest in, not necessarily just projects. And so, you know, finding your people, finding the ones that you connect with and that get you, that feel like they're going somewhere in the industry. Those are the people that I'll do anything to like continue to work with them.
It comes back to how you were sort of named multiple times for this project in particular, like the people that you had connected with in two separate spheres had both named you and brought you to the table for this project. So you're proof that it works. That's awesome.
All of the projects that I had done with all of those people that brought my name to the table were free.
Oh my gosh. There you go. Oh, well, thank you so much, Lucas, for joining us. And thank you for taking the time and congratulations.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Yes, this was great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, Lucas, for joining us and for taking us through your process. I especially loved hearing about that period of time where you let yourself be lost in a sea of footage. I think it's very important for us to let ourselves have time and space to sit in ambiguity and let the story unfold for us. It's very easy to want to get to crafting and creating and figuring out what it is, but sometimes you just have to sit with it. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in. You can get more No Film School at nofilmschool.com. You can like, rate, and subscribe to the podcast and let us know what you thought in the comments. And finally, you can follow us on social at No Film School. Thanks so much.